return it today. It was great. It was great.
You needed a learner tie.
Mm-hmm. I was on Wheel of Fortune last night.
Famous tie.
Wheel of Fortune. Vanna White admired it.
Seriously? You are.
Yeah, they're coming to town, so I was doing their promo spots last
That's
night.
Impressive.
Yeah, I know. Vanna's very nice.
That's what
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the City Council Chambers. Before we begin, we have some special presentations, and we also have a four-fifths resolution item. But before we begin with that, I would just like to express on behalf of the City Council our deep sympathy to our colleague, Randy Leonard, and his family for the loss of a loved one, his daughter. It is an opportunity to talk to the commissioner, and obviously this is devastating. They're working hard to make sure that her son, his grandson, is getting all the care and special attention that he needs. And so I just ask that you would join me for a moment of silence and reflection and good thoughts for our colleague Randy and his family. Thank you. We've also, as a result of this, had a number of folks contacting our offices, raising concerns about their own health or the health of somebody else that they know or love, and ask Commissioner Fritz to give some advice on what to do in those situations.
Thank you, Mayor. And this obviously is a tragedy for our whole community, and it reflects the struggles that many people are having. So if folks need to talk to somebody about their own concerns or concerns for somebody in their family, the number to call is the Multnomah County Crisis Line, and the number is 503-988-4888. And that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's staffed by professional mental health counselors. And again, that number is 988-4888. Commissioner Leonard has some information on his blog on his website as to other ways to honor his daughter, Kara.
So thank you all. Also, we have a special presentation. If we could have our colleagues from the Bureau of Transportation, Public Works Maintenance Group, please come forward. And as you are seated, I'm pleased to declare this American Public Works Week, and with the following proclamation. Whereas the American Public Works Association has selected Public Works Serving You and Your Community as its theme for 2011 National Public Works Week, which is celebrated May 15th through May 21st, to call attention to the importance of public works in community life. And whereas public works services provided in our city are an integral part of our citizens' everyday lives and are basic to the quality of life for our residents and businesses. And whereas the health, safety, and comfort of our community and neighborhoods greatly depend on public works infrastructure and services such as clean drinking water, stormwater management, wastewater treatment, street and sidewalk maintenance, street lights and traffic signals, park maintenance, public buildings, waste collection and recycling. And that's just a very small list. It's actually much, much longer. And whereas the support of an informed and understanding citizenry is vital to the efficient operation of public work systems and programs for the present and future generation of Portlanders, now therefore I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim May 15th to May 21st to be Public Works Week in Portland, and I call upon all citizens to acquaint themselves with the issues involved in providing our public works and to recognize the contributions of the great men and women in Portland who provide and maintain our infrastructure. Congratulations. Director Miller.
Good morning, Mayor Adams, Commissioner Saltzman, Commissioner Fritz, Commissioner Fish, good morning. It's my pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Tom Miller, Director of the Bureau of Transportation for the City of Portland. And Mayor, as you noted, this isn't the American Public Works Week is an important week for us here at the City of Portland, particularly the major infrastructure bureaus of transportation, environmental services, water, parks, and so forth. It's Public Works Week in America. It's an opportunity for us to pause and take note of the thousands, literally thousands of men and women who serve us every day in keeping our city running. With more than 580,000 residents in 145 square miles, I need not remind you that the basic maintenance and operations of the city is no small task. In transportation alone, we have 750 diversely classified employees, 184 classifications, 75 work schedules, 7 different work groups, and of course, they all work 24/7. Sometimes 365. If we get a big snow and ice event over Christmas, we're out there, right? That's our responsibility to the citizens. There's $8.8 billion in transportation infrastructure in the city alone. And I'm told with regard to sewer and stormwater, Commissioner Saltzman's portfolio, there's $5.9 billion in sewer and stormwater facilities as well. And if my colleague David Schaff were able to join us today, I'm sure the investment in water infrastructure would be significant as well. I'm confident in that. And these are the men and women who make it work every single day on behalf of citizens. So without further ado, I want to introduce two of our key folks here at the Bureau of Maintenance. You've heard some of the facts from me, but the facts are always more compelling when they come with faces. And we've got two of our standouts here. To my left, Lanny Eels, correct? It's a Welsh name I just learned. Lanny Eels is a public works supervisor for us in the sewer cleaning and repair section. He's worked his way up through our maintenance division, bringing a great combination of diligence and innovation to the workplace. In 2009, Lanny was the first City of Portland employee ever to earn a spot on the Emerging Leaders Academy, which is sponsored by the American Public Works Association. Lanny, thank you for your everyday leadership on behalf of all Portlanders. We appreciate that. And to my right, Daryl Warren. Good morning. He's a utility worker one for us in our street maintenance division. He started in 1999, and he too has worked his way up the chain of command within our maintenance shop and now oversees 90 employees improving safety on our roads, no matter how we get around, whether it's whatever mode of transportation, we're out there making sure that when we're doing the work that we do, it's as safe as possible for everybody out there. And that's Daryl's fundamental responsibility. As our commissioner in charge, Mayor Adams, notes regularly, safety is job one in transportation, and that's exactly what Daryl does every single day. Daryl's fundamental charge is to make sure that when we're out in the streets doing what needs to be done, we're doing so in a safe manner, not just for our employees, but for citizens as well. Daryl, we appreciate your efforts. Finally, I might just note that due to the proclamation, Portland Online, our website now features on the homepage a link to a pretty cool slideshow showing our folks in action, whether it's the Bureau of Transportation's maintenance team or folks outside the realm of transportation. There's a nice, quick slideshow that shows what the work looks like in action. We appreciate your support, Mayor, and all members of City Council, and we thank you for your time.
Well, congratulations on Public Works Week. Lanny and Daryl, thank you, and all of your colleagues in helping keep us safe and maintained and operating. We appreciate it. Thank you. And you can leave if you want. You do not have to stay for the rest of council. We will not be offended. All right. City Council will come to order officially. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning.
Can you please call the roll?
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Leonard. Fritz.
Here.
Adams.
Here. Quorum is present. We'll proceed with the agenda, starting with communications. Can you please read the first item?
Item 444, request of Hector Lara Cervantes to address council regarding illegal operations and experiments done on citizens.
Mr. Cervantes? Okay, not present. Can you please read communications item number 445?
Request of Art Llewellyn to address council regarding the Columbia River crossing is not shovel ready.
Mr. Llewellyn, welcome back. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. The handouts that the clerk will pass along to you, you've seen before, but I've submitted them before, and want to go over the latest... my latest sense about what's going on with the project, and I think the public really is left in the dark about it. And for as long as it's been going on, the longer it goes on, the more the public just it cannot come to some kind of consensus about supporting it. I think it's at least 2 years behind schedule. And principally, the Hayden Island interchange is the sticking point for me on the project. The design to me is unsafe. You don't want to trade a working interchange on Hayden Island for one that is statistically less safe. It's less safe. There's just no question the way that you have to exit the freeway and then come to a stop and then turn, and where traffic is already gathering there to get onto the freeway on the other side on both sides. That design's just not acceptable, I think, to too many people. So I come to speak not just for myself. I'll come down when I'm supportive of some project, and I'll come down and comment when I have to be critical, because the design has been this design you've supposedly accepted is been accepted for so long, and I just still can't believe it. A year ago in August, the committee planners came up with a design, which I was finally able to get behind. It's concept number one. It's in the draft there. And a week later, it was rejected. And I have been since then trying to get it back onto the table so that the public will get a fair look at it. And so that's basically what I'm here to repeat before the council, as well as look at how concept number one could be amended to come close to the kind of costs and impacts that the accepted interchange there for Hayden Island and North Portland would work. So I've gone to a lot of trouble. And I produced some, I think, pretty good maps. I think people can look at them and say, so. I am on the side of the argument that says, well, I probably it's going to have to be replaced one day, so I'm not against that. I do like the common sense alternative design for taking it in phases, and I think that's the only way we're going to be able to get project going and start something small. So thanks for letting me give that comment, and I think that sums it up. Thank you, Council.
Thank you, sir, very much. I appreciate it. All right, before we move to the time certain, there's a 4/5 that I'm going to move, requires me to, I make a motion to suspend the rules.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. The purpose of the motion to suspend the rules is to consider this 4/5 resolution in front of us that recognize and honors the accomplishments of Harold Schnitzer, who is having a memorial service tomorrow.
Today.
So it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion to suspend the rules? Carla, would you please call the vote on the motion to suspend the rules?
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Rules are suspended to consider the draft resolution before us. Any discussion or questions on the draft resolution?
Mayor, I was just going to point out the memorial service, I believe, is today.
Sorry, it is today, not tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. Okay, Carla, can you please call the vote on the resolution before us?
Let's read the title. Okay. Recognize and honor the vision, generosity, and many civic and professional accomplishments of Harold Schnitzer and offer condolences to his family. Did you want to offer a testimony?
Anyone wish to testify on this matter? Can you please call the vote?
Fish?
First, Mayor, thank you for bringing this resolution forward. Harold Schnitzer impacted our community in many ways, but perhaps one way that is not as well known is that he is a major property owner of multifamily apartment buildings downtown, which operate with significant federal subsidies. And after 15 years, when those federal subsidies expire, the properties can be converted to market rent, thereby resulting in the displacement of usually older, more frail, lower-income individuals. Mr. Schnitzer believed strongly that that housing should be preserved for people that it serves. And therefore, during his lifetime, he was a key partner in our preservation strategy, keeping what we call expiring use properties affordable by partnering with nonprofits that came in to run them. And the only way that works is to have a willing owner that has the vision to maintain the affordability and the willingness to sell the property at a discount to another operator to preserve the housing. At the time of his death, there were two projects that he was negotiating with the city, which we fully hope and expect will be carried on by his estate. He never sought any attention for that work, but I can tell you that it had an enormous impact on dozens and dozens of low-income older adults in our community. The day after he died, I was at a luncheon honoring his son, Jordan Schnitzer, and Lewis and Clark College Law School gave Jordan their highest award. Many people assumed that Jordan would not come to the event since he was mourning. Instead, he did come to the event, and he shared a story of his last conversation with his father the day before. In the last conversation he had with his father, in honor of Jordan's upcoming birthday, proposed to give a substantial gift to Lewis and Clark Law School in the name of the family to continue the work that he cared so deeply about. And Jordan said that his final act in his life was to authorize a family grant to pursue something they both cared about. I would say that's consistent with everything that I've known about the man. I did not know him well. His family has been a generous benefactor of our park system and worked with us on housing. But this is a great loss, and I think it's appropriate for us to honor him and give our respects to Jordan and to his widow. And I thank you, Mayor, for bringing this resolution forward so that we can give our respect to him and his family. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, thank you, Mayor, for bringing this resolution. Harold Schnitzer's grandparents, like my grandparents, fled from Ukraine and Russia because of the tremendous anti-Semitism that existed in those countries at those times. Some may argue that anti-Semitism hasn't gone away in those countries. But nevertheless, in the time when of pogroms and people being killed or beaten because of their religion, temples being burned and scarred across the landscape of Ukraine and Russia, his grandparents, like my grandparents, sought a better life, and they came to this country. Interestingly enough, both our families, and this was not uncommon for Jewish immigrants, went into the scrap metal business. I will tell you, hands down, the Schnitzer family was far more successful in the scrap metal business than my grandfather was, who really never, my grandfather never really progressed beyond having a truck and scrap metal that he would pick up from people and sell. Obviously, Schnitzer Steel is one of the most successful Oregon companies we have. Harold chose not to go into the scrap metal business and pursued real estate and became very successful, like my father. He also didn't get into the scrap metal business and actually got into real estate and did very well himself. I believe there's always been sort of, I think we're part of the extended family. If you talk to whose cousins of whose cousins, you know, the Schnitzers and the Saltzmans are always kind of showing up at events in one form or another as cousins of sorts. And I always will regard them as that. And Harold was such a modest, gentle person, but obviously very, very generous. He and Arlene and Jordan have been a very generous family to not only the Jewish community, but to also the arts community, the health research community. It's hard to know where it stops. I did have a chance to speak to Harold probably 2 or 3 weeks before he passed, and I guess I should point out that both, because he pointed it out, and I'm surprised he remembered this, but both Harold and I are alums of MIT, and I was surprised that he sort of remembered that, especially as he was very close to passing. But I just really want to say this is a great opportunity for me personally and for this council to honor and recognize the tremendous contribution of the son of immigrants has made to this community. and I'm pleased to vote aye.
Fritz.
It's interesting how we're all connected, and something like this can give evidence of that. My grandfather was a scrap metal merchant also, but his only child became a dental hygienist rather than going into real estate. I want to read from the resolution, and I hope this will be posted online later. Harold was born the fifth of seven children of Russian immigrants Rose and Sam Schnitzer in 1923. He attended Portland's Lincoln High School, and in preparation to work in the family steel business, went on to study metallurgy at the age of 16 at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, graduated in 1944, and served in the United States Army in World War II. So that's quite a start in life, and obviously evidence of the intelligence and vigor that he had lived his life. Harold Schnitzer taught his son Jordan, look out for the other fellow. Appreciate the opportunity and good fortune you have been blessed with, what this country offered to its millions of immigrants. And indeed, our city continues to offer a new life for hundreds of thousands of immigrants, and we appreciate the opportunities that we have speaking as an immigrant. Harold Schnitzer believed, if you have the resources and the ability, use them to make your community better than it was when you arrived. So I'm grateful to you, Mayor, for bringing this resolution, and I'm proud to vote aye.
Adams.
Well, it is very rare for the City Council to memorialize the passing of one of our citizens by resolution. It is reserved for the most generous of the most generous. And Harold Schnitzer, Arlene Jordan, and their family have definitely been that. A family of immigrants, a self-made family, who absolutely gave back at every opportunity they could and more. And I would just add to the very thoughtful comments of my colleagues by noting the support, and oftentimes the largest support, of countless creative legacies, including Fountain Gallery, Portland Art Museum, the Oregon Symphony, and the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, and the Portland Center for the Performing Arts, among other arts and culture organizations that they've supported over the years. They have served as a fantastic, inspiring example to the rest of us when it comes to civic involvement. I'm pleased to vote aye. Resolution approved. We'll now move to time certain resolution, item number 446.
I'm going to do the consent agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Anyone wish to pull any items from the consent agenda? Please call the vote on the consent. Well, we can't now.
Yeah.
Okay, please read the title for time certain, item number 446.
Recognize May 2011 as Foster Care Awareness Month and honor foster care programs funded by the Portland Children's Levy.
Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. To coincide with National Foster Care Awareness Month, which is May, I'd like to acknowledge the outstanding work being done by those Portland programs that are doing all they can to help children in foster care succeed. Specifically, those programs supported by the Portland Children's Levy is our highlight today. Helping foster children succeed is a new investment area for the Portland Children's Levy. It was added by the voters when the levy was renewed in 2008. The voters recognized the great need to help nurture these children. We have invested in 9 programs, and you'll hear about those shortly. These programs are actively engaged in helping foster care children overcome incredible barriers, including poverty, housing instability, underemployment, and education levels lower than their peers. It is a fact that only 3% of children in foster care in Oregon receive 4-year degrees in the state of Oregon. To tell us more about the Portland Children Levy investments, Lisa Hansel, who oversees our grants, will give us a short presentation, and they will be followed by a distinguished panel of providers and experts who will discuss how their programs are helping children beat some very high odds. Lisa?
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Thank you for taking the time today to recognize Foster Care Awareness Month, and also to acknowledge the work being done through the 9 foster care programs funded by the Children's Levy. As Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, foster care is a new program area for the levy, and during the first term of investment, which is July 1st, 2009 through June 30th, 2012, the levy has invested $4.9 million in programs that help children in foster care succeed. Approximately 500 children receive services from 9 programs in this funding area. African American and Native American children are overrepresented in the foster care system. According to the decision point analysis work that PSU completed in 2009, African American children were 2 times and Native American children 16.5 times more likely to be represented in foster care than their representation in the child population in Multnomah County. With the first year of operation, the levy-funded programs successfully reached both of these populations. About 28% of the children served were African American, and about 20% served through the levy-funded programs were Native American. Both of those are very close to the percentages of the children in the foster care system in Multnomah County. This map shows the administrative offices and schools where levy-funded services are provided. Please note that not shown on this map are over 120 child care providers, 36 Head Start sites, and the home-based services. The blue dots on the map represent the foster care programs funded through levy dollars. If you look closely, you'll notice there aren't very many blue dots, but the purple dots, those represent programs and organizations that are funded to provide services in more than one of our funding areas, which many of the foster care programs fall into this category. There are 9 programs funded in the foster care program area. They include Big Brothers Big Sisters, Project Hope, which is a mentoring program, Boys and Girls Aid, Wendy's Wonderful Kids, and they provide services to find permanent adoptive homes for children in foster care. And you'll hear more about this service from one of our panel members. Children's Relief Nursery provides trauma assessment, therapeutic nursery for young children, home visits, and parenting education for both biological and foster parents. Impact Northwest, their Safe and Together program, provides child development services for children 0 to 5, and support and education also for biological and foster parents with specialized services for fathers. Janus Insights, their ECHO program, provides case management and parent education for teen parents and their young children where either or both the teen parent and or the child is in foster care. Utes Rights and Justice, Attorneys at Law, their school works program, provides legal representation, advocacy, and case management activities addressing the educational needs of children in foster care. You'll also hear more about this program as they're represented on the panel as well. Legacy Health, the medical home program, provides health coordination and health education services. Native American Youth and Family Center provides case management and enrichment services. They recruit Native American foster parents and provide support and education for both foster and biological parents. And the last program, Self Enhancement, Inc., provides comprehensive in-school and out-of-school services for African American youth and support for foster families. With that overview of the foster care funding area, I'd like to introduce our panel. They'll come up for each separately. So Sally Geyer from Wendy's Wonderful Kids, with Boys and Girls Aid. Lynn Haxton from Youth Rights and Justice Attorneys at Law, and they'll talk about the School Works program. Joining her will be Gail Martinez Parker, a DHS caseworker, and Mike Katarina, a foster parent. And then we'll end the presentation with Angela Cause from DHS Child Welfare, and she'll give some information about disproportionality and the work that is being done in Multnomah County to address disproportionality or overrepresentation of African American and Native American children in the foster care system. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Aye. If you could just give us your name and
absolutely. Yeah. Good morning, Mayor Adams, Commissioner Fish, Commissioner Fritz, and Commissioner Saltzman. My name is Sally Geyer, and I am the Child and Family Services Program Supervisor at Boys and Girls Aid, Oregon's oldest child welfare agency. I am here this morning to continue to celebrate the National Foster Care Awareness Month. Last fiscal year, nearly 3,000 of Multnomah County's children spent at least one night in foster care. Many of these children will eventually return home or will be placed in a permanent placement with a relative or a caregiver, but a full 25% of these children are without a safe place to return to. They do not have a family resource. Nobody stepping forward to say that they will care for the child, and these children are at risk for growing up in a myriad of systems where every living situation is temporary. This means they will have a number of adults who come in and out of their lives, and they don't have permanency. These children are at risk for developing unhealthy attachments and not having the ability to be positive and supportive members of our community. They have higher risks of being incarcerated, underemployed, and lifelong consumers of the mental health system. These outcomes are unacceptable, but more importantly, these outcomes are preventable. When children and youth have a safe, loving, permanent caregiver, they are able to reach for their full potential, and that is what I am here to celebrate. Boys and Girls Aid receives funding from the Portland Children's Levy to help us recruit families for Portland's waiting children. Through the collaborative relationships with the Oregon Heart Gallery, Wendy's Wonderful Kids, and the Oregon Department of Human Services, we have been able to find families that are ready to take on the lifelong needs of youth and children living in temporary foster homes. The levy funds have helped us create dynamic and personalized recruitment plans for children and sibling groups. We are able to give individualized attention to specific cases for which DHS has run out of resources. And on behalf of these children who so desperately want and need a permanent living home, we are able to publish newsletters, attend community events, network in the community organizations, and share their stories with anyone who will listen. These stories often touch the hearts of people who previously had never thought about adopting a child from the foster care system. The photographs behind me represent such a story. Madison, Chase, Hayden, and Jada came into the Oregon foster care system in 2005. They came from a family with many struggles and few resources. Madison, the oldest, often played the role of a parent to her younger siblings, even though she was just a child herself. And after several years of trying to locate a permanent home for these resilient children, DHS referred this case to Boys and Girls Aid Wonderful Kids program. Using levy funds, we were able to print the photos from a professional photo shoot in combination with the Oregon Heart Gallery, and we were able to publish articles in our foster care adoption newsletter and to purchase print ads in many local publications and create some informational bookmarks, examples of which I believe have been distributed to the council members. I am happy to report that in December of 2010, not one, but two families were identified for Madison, Chase, Hayden, and Jada, leaving DHS with the very high-class problem of having to choose the very best family for these dynamic children. In February, Madison, Chase, Hayden, and Jada moved to New York City to be with their new mom, a special education teacher, and their new dad, a New York City firefighter. Since exiting the foster care system, Madison no longer has to be the caregiver for her brothers and sisters. She is learning that she can have friends who are her age and has interests beyond making sure everyone gets fed. Chase is playing sports and has become the star of his basketball team. Hayden follows his dad around learning whatever he can, and Jada, the youngest, is taking dance lessons and reports that she gets to wear her pink tutu anytime she wants. In short, these children went home. But the story doesn't end there, because there are still Madison's, Chase's, Haydens, and Jadas who haven't found their forever home yet. We need continued funding so that we can help more children find their forever families. I brought a few of their pictures with me. Christopher simply just wants a family that will be nice to him. Daquan needs a family that loves music. Ashley, Britt, and Kiara are going to thrive in a family that is active. Isaiah just wants to be outdoors, having fun. And Jeremiah, whoever gets to be his parent, will be very lucky to share their lives with this dynamic little man. So we haven't done any of these children justice if we stop sharing their stories or asking people to consider the possibility of creating that permanent family that these children are waiting every day to find. So I'd leave you with one question. Are you the family they're waiting for?
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you very much.
So next is we have Lynn Haxton with the Youth Rights and Justice Project. And she's brought some guests.
Lynn?
Okay. And I guess we should, you're probably going to say it, but your former name, just.
Yes.
Okay, your organization's formerly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. My name is Lynn Haxton. I'm a staff attorney with Youth Rights and Justice, formerly the Juvenile Rights Project. I am here today with a caseworker, Gail Martinez Parker, and a foster parent, Mike Katerina. And we are going to highlight three foster children for you and how the School Works program has helped them. And I really want to thank you for allowing us to come and speak to you about what the School Works program does. The School Works program focuses on helping abused and neglected children by advocating in the schools for them. Our goal is to help them get in school, stay in school, have the supports they need in school, and ultimately graduate and hopefully go to college and beat those odds of less than 3% of foster children getting a four-year college degree. So since 2002, SchoolWorks has been successful in advocating for educational stability, avoiding unnecessary school moves, helping enroll students in schools, advocating for needed services in schools and assessments, really trying to help our most at-risk children succeed in school. So rather than go on about just in general terms, we're going to talk about three very special children. The first child I'm going to talk about is Jenny. She experienced multiple trauma and abuse at a very young age, along with her siblings. She was removed at age 4 from her family with 3 siblings she placed in foster care. She changed foster homes for a number of times and eventually was separated from two of her siblings. And then the state was able to get her returned along with her siblings to one of her parents for a period, but that failed and they reentered the foster care system. So by now, Jenny has experienced lots of trauma and loss in her life. But she's a very sweet girl. And she internalized her trauma and her anxiety, whereas a lot of kids externalize and have behaviors that scream, "I need help," she didn't. But in fourth grade, she began to have phantom pains and complaints, and often at school. So she would exaggerate an injury or complain about stomach pain, and foster parents worked with the school and decided this was probably attention-seeking behavior, and they tried to minimize the attention that she would get around those. Well, in fifth grade, Jenny's a very smart girl, and she was smart enough to figure out a way to get the adults' attention that they couldn't ignore. And she wrote a bomb threat on the school bathroom wall. Unfortunately, Jenny's not a very good speller, and her misspellings on that little bomb threat enabled them to catch who wrote the message on the school. And so in spite of the fact she was only 10 years old, and had experienced severe trauma, the school didn't really, they failed to step back and kind of look, this is really a cry for help. This girl needs our help and support. And they moved to expel her from school. And that's when SchoolWorks stepped in. And we were able to show that this was a cry for help and related to her anxiety disorder, which she had already been diagnosed with. But we thought all the supports we had in place were helping her manage it, but it was really just simmering under the surface. We could not dissuade the school from expelling her. However, we were able to minimize that expulsion to 2.5 weeks, make sure she had education during that time period, get her disability recognized by the school, and get a good support plan in place so when she returned to school, we could really support her and help her be successful. So the support plan we worked on capitalized on Jenny's strengths and tried to meet her needs around her anxiety. We were able to get have her be an aide in the functional life skills class, which she absolutely loved and was just a model aide in helping those the other low-functioning children. She became a helper in the SUN program after school. We got a list of supports at the school, so when she felt anxious or had a problem, she had people she could go to, she could count on. We got extended time on tasks to reduce her anxiety level at school. We developed check-ins with the teacher, more communication with the foster parent and the school. So we had a lot of supports. We had some other supports in place for her. All these supports and this advocacy made a huge difference for Jenny. She's now in the 7th grade. She has a 3.2 GPA. She could have easily been a statistic. Which would have been as a result of increasing seclusion from school, resulting from suspensions and expulsions, falling further and further behind in school, becoming disengaged from school, and then ultimately resistant to school. But instead, we have a good support plan. She still has her anxiety. We meet every year. We revise the plan and monitor it. SchoolWorks is part of the team that comes together and makes sure that she's getting the support she needs. And I think Jenny has a good chance of beating the odds and being great. So, but we didn't do this in a vacuum. SchoolWorks did a lot of work, but we don't do it in a vacuum. There are, on this case particular, we have fantastic foster parents and a fantastic caseworker, both of whom are here today. And they have four children in this family that we, three of whom we've worked with. And so the caseworker is going to highlight one, and the foster parent's going to highlight one of the other children.
Welcome. Hi, I'm Gail Martinez Parker. I'm a child welfare caseworker in the Gresham branch of DHS here in Multnomah County. Good morning, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. It's nice to be here to talk to you about these wonderful programs. I want to say on behalf of DHS, we love all these programs, but the SchoolWorks program is particularly helpful to us in regards to the children's education. And the reason for that is that many of our children who come into care are on individual education plans. And as a result of that, we meet with the school districts to make sure that their needs are met. And we know that when we have the Youth Rights and Justice program with us, that the children's needs are going to be met. Because we'll sit down as a team, like you see before you right now, with the school and talk about what the children's needs are and how they can be met. Because we know our children are the ones that, unfortunately, are disadvantaged more so than other children in our community. So the child I'm going to talk about in this sibling group is Evan. And when he came into care, he was 6 years old. He had suffered physical abuse, witnessed domestic violence, and also experienced neglect. His mother was a meth user, and his father, unfortunately, was incarcerated at the time and continues to be incarcerated at this time. Evan was in half-day hospitalization, day treatment is what we call it, because he was not able to be maintained in any classroom in our community. So he was in half-day hospitalization for a number of months, and we continued to meet in regards to his education plan with, we called him JRP at the time, and the school districts. Eventually, he was able to go to a behavioral classroom in his neighborhood school, and he was in that classroom for a number of years, and we continued to meet with the school several times a year to make sure that his needs were met with the Youth Rights and Justice program with us side by side in order for that to happen. And as Evan continued to recover from the trauma that he had experienced, he received a diagnosis of Asperger's disorder, which is on the autism spectrum. So it gave us a whole new look at what was troubling him and how we could help him and how we should rearrange his educational plan in order to meet his needs. And so as time went on, we continued to do that, and he continued to be successful in his program and eventually was able to be mainstreamed. When he was in the 4th grade, he started doing some mainstreaming. By the time he got to middle school, he was able to mainstream in the school. In fact, this year, The school district came back and felt like he had recovered enough that he didn't need to be on an individual education program. And so we had to kind of advocate around that because autism doesn't go away. It continues. And even with him functioning at the level that he is, we believe that with the assistance and the support that he's received, that he's going to be a scientist someday. He's a brilliant young man. And with the help that he has, is able to manage himself in school to gain from his education.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for
your work. Hi, I'm Mike Katerina, a foster parent. I don't do this very often, so bear with me. Andy, the child I'm talking about, he had a lot of trouble when he first came into the high school system. His first year, he got like 2 credits out of 6 or 7. Felt he was doomed to fail. Didn't really participate or try very hard. And it was because of the history of his siblings and himself. He got help, though, through SchoolWorks. They helped us and him set up an individual education plan. He's now 18 and will graduate. So we've been through quite a few struggles with this, but I really have to say that I think SchoolWorks was very important in helping us get through his high school education and helping him succeed. So I can't say enough about their program and how it's helped us with not only him and our other foster children too. So very much appreciated.
Thank you very much for foster parenting. It's obvious, it's one child at a time, and it's a family at a time, and you're making a huge difference. Thank you, all of you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you
very much.
We wish Jenny, Evan, and Andy much success in life.
Thank you.
So our final speaker is Angela Cause with the Department of Human Services.
Technically challenged.
Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mayor Adams, Commissioners Fritz, Salzman, and Fish. I am very pleased to have the opportunity to share with you this morning and reiterate some of the points that you've heard from earlier members of the panel. I've had the opportunity, or I should say we, the Department of Human Services, to work in a collaborative effort over the last 18 months to 2 years, working towards a safe and equitable reduction of children in foster care. Multnomah County has had the honor of being a part of a project targeted specifically for that. My name is Angela Cause. I am with the Department of Human Services, working out of our District 2 Multnomah County office here. In the Portland area, and work specifically around this area of disproportionality involved in educating and informing the community about this particular issue, and specifically the Native American and African American communities. There's an African tribe, the Maasai tribe, that traditionally has use the term in greeting one another of how are the children. And I'm sure it's something that you probably have heard before and you might be familiar with, but I want to remind you of it this morning because the significance of how a community is thriving is measured by this particular tribe, and I would hope here in our county it serves the same, that how we are doing is measured beyond our economic stability and other things, but more specifically, how are our children doing? Because that speaks to the future. And if our children are faring well, then our community overall is faring well. the safe and equitable reduction of children in foster care has been a goal, as I mentioned, over the last couple of years. We had hoped by the year, this current year of 2011, to reach a reduction of children in foster care by 20%. This partnership has been involved, including DHS, our local and state Commission on Children and Family offices, Tribes, Casey Family Programs out of Seattle has been here giving us much financial and other support in this effort. We've worked hand in hand with our judicial system and with Portland State University. Here in Multnomah County, the three entities that have worked most closely together under the support of a steering committee has been the Department of Human Services, the commissions of Children, Families, and Communities, and we've had the court system using their Child Welfare Council. Why has this been such a focus for us over the last couple of years? Well, Oregon, despite our size, when we look at states such as Texas and California, we're not as large, nor do we have the population. But Oregon has one of the highest foster care placement rates in the country. In 2009, our foster care placement rate per 1,000 exceeded the national average. The national average is 5.6. In Oregon, we're at 10%, at 10, and in Multnomah County, we exceed the state by 13.8. For children who are in foster care, and in Multnomah County, about 25,000 children in foster care. As we heard earlier, the statistics about 3% of children from foster care graduating from college. We want to note that in order to get to college, you first have got to graduate from high school. And children in foster care are more likely to drop out of high school, have a difficult time moving forward and functioning in society, so they are more likely to commit crimes, be involved with drugs, and also to become teen parents. Emphasis here, while we're acknowledging foster care this month and the importance of it, one key thing for foster care for us to bear in mind is that it is temporary. We had Wendy's wonderful children share with us earlier the significance of placing children for adoption. Our end point is to move children through the system, either returning them to their biological families or onto some other permanent home. In reducing the number of children, we have focused on reducing children entering care, looking at an increase in our foster care exits, increasing relative placements, reducing disproportionality and disparities for Native American and African American children, and to hold our reabuse rate stable. That last one is very significant because if we're having the numbers go down, we want to make sure that as those numbers decrease, we don't have situations like little Jenny that we heard about earlier who returns to foster care for reabuse. If you look at the navy blue line there at the top, it represents Multnomah County, and the lighter blue line, the teal, represents the state. And you can see that for the past 5 years, we have had somewhat of a steady decrease for the number of children in foster care, although we still exceed the national average. When we think of children in foster care, we often think of a lot of the horrific cases. Sexual abuse in particular is one that comes to mind. But I want to call your attention to this larger area there of threat of harm. Many of our children who are in foster care are in care because of threat of harm, and that speaks to harm that might be related to poverty, impoverished families, as well as domestic violence. So when we think of the supports that families need, it's those types of supports to maintain stability for them. When we worked with PSU, we joined in three areas to focus on. We looked at a literary review to see what exactly was being put out there in research regarding disproportionality and disparity and what were the promising practices. PSU worked with us in looking at our administrative data to identify where within our decision points we were having disproportionality occur in our system. And then we went out to the community and spoke with numerous entities in several focus groups, the courts, caseworkers, parents, grandparents, about that data and asked them their specific thoughts around why this was happening in our county and in our state. The key decision points that we looked at were intake, screening, disposition, removal hold, foster care placement, foster care stay, the case plan that the child received, and exits. African-American, and we heard this earlier, African-American and Native American families are nearly three times more likely to be reported. And that's from our mandatory report, is the more likely mandatory report is being law enforcement, medical staff, and also educators. Black families are two times more likely to be reported. Removal for children, roughly 40% of all children who are assessed are removed. But when we look at Native American children, 55% of those children who were assessed are removed. So we have a particular concern for both Native American and African American children. But if you look at Native American, theirs in particular causes alarm. We have a social...
I'm sorry, but we've exceeded our budgeted time for this. Can you wrap up real quickly for us?
I sure will. Let me take you to...
Can you send us a link to this so I can put a link to my website, because this is really good information.
Sure,
that I think
my apology
need to hear about.
For running over time. No, so let me tell you then exactly in Multnomah County what we have done. We have, in addressing this issue, worked towards increasing the number of relative placements that we have, and we've moved from 09 from having 17.5% up to 30% relative placement. So we're able to place children with kin more so than we have in the past. Another major increase for us in Multnomah County is that we have, or I should say, we've decreased the number of children coming into foster care. Now, there's a slight decrease, about 100 children, but it is a decrease. While we've decreased the number of children coming into care all overall, we have not yet impacted the disproportionality for Native American and African American children, so we're continuing to have to work towards that. And what we've done worked with community providers in increasing the number of culturally specific services, particularly targeting those two communities, particularly on the front end, shifting our funding to give more support to Native American and African American children at the entry point of foster care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you very much. Has anyone signed up to testify on this matter?
No one else signed up.
Does anyone wish to testify that did not sign up but is in the room? All righty. It is a resolution. Carla, can you please call the vote on the resolution?
Fish?
Well, we have a little box on our screen. Anyway, thank you for the presentations this morning. And as I listened to the very compelling testimony, I was reminded that increasingly Resolution A does not make any sense in our community. The old separation between what the city and county does makes no sense. Commissioner Saltzman is a city commissioner, and yet through his work, funding is going in for housing to provide a place for foster children to live in an intergenerational community. Is that a city responsibility or a county responsibility? We can have that debate, but I think Resolution A no longer gives us much clarity in how to resolve that debate. And I think at some point what this community needs to do is revisit the question of who is responsible for what, and with a less of an emphasis on the separation between county and city functions and more of a focus on how working together we can do a better job of meeting the needs of our community. And I would say in law enforcement, social services, housing, conspicuously, these are areas that we ought to revisit. Resolution A was appropriate for its day. And I think it actually, it's long overdue that we should revisit that and ask the question about who does what and how do we fund it. But anyway, thank you all for your tremendous work in the trenches, making a difference in the community in which we live. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I want to thank everybody here today in honor and raising awareness about National Foster Care Awareness Month. I want to thank our foster parent, Mike, for coming here today. You did a great job. And I want to wish the, as I said earlier, the three foster children that were profiled, Jenny, Evan, and Andy, all the success in the world. And I think that foster kids demand everybody's attention and rise above, as Commissioner Frist said, sort of jurisdictional barriers that sometimes can get in the way. These kids